Hello, I'm Father Dermot McCarthy, and this is the Breffni Early Show.
Breffni, you come all the way from Ireland for this adventure.
Isn't Breffni Early a real tonic, full of positivity?
It's an amazing story, Breffni, with a wonderful, happy ending.
All of those things on your bucket list, though, wouldn't necessarily have led you to do the World Cycle Race.
27 countries, 490 days, 18,000 miles on a bike.
You've decided that's it. You're going to keep giving yourself challenges.
Welcome to the Breffni Early Show, where each week we bring you a guest who is interesting, inspirational and motivational. This one is also a little bit special for me personally because my guest is my uncle, Father Dermot McCarthy. Welcome to the show, Dermot.
Thank you very much, Breffni.
I won't call you Uncle Dermot. No, geez, that's normally what I would call you. It's great to have you on the show. You've been a part of my life since the day I was born. You christened me. You've given all the sacraments the whole way up through my life. And you've been around for all the major points of my life. But I suppose...
Still waiting for a marriage, by the way. That's
yeah, you could be waiting a little bit longer.
You know?
I'm fully aware. You could be waiting a little bit longer on that one.
Okay.
I know I've been a massive disappointment to you on that score. You've led a very, very interesting life. And we're going to talk about loads and loads of things over the next hour, maybe. We're going to talk about your time at RIARC, where you produced some fantastic documentaries across the world with some fascinating people as interviewees and as contributors to those shows. We're also going to talk about your time in RTE as the chaplain to RTE.
And well, I wouldn't use the word chaplain. As pastoral care.
As pastoral care.
Facilitator.
And obviously...
I don't use the word chaplain because that gives a hostage to fortune. Just imagine Phoenix Magazine, RTE is chaplain. They need one, all right. You know, no, pastoral care, please.
But the period in the middle also where you spent time in the Pro-Cathedral, St. Mary's Pro-Cathedral in Dublin, and I suppose the main body of work that most people will be familiar with you for in the last 20 or 30 years as the head of religious programming in RTE. And obviously the voice, they might not remember the name or they might not know the name, some people, but they will recognise the voice from such shows as the Christmas events and the Easter events that you run and the carol services, but also the Pope's funeral, John Paul II funeral, and also Mother Teresa's funeral, which I know you hosted with Mary Kennedy. But I want to rewind a few years. I'm not going to give the listeners how many years we're rewinding, but back to Ballinamore, County Leitrim, where it all began.
Yes, indeed. Ballinamore, County Leitrim, great little town, but it needs more industry at the moment, but it's a great spirit in the town of Ballinamore. And that's where I grew up. And there was, I wasn't really a GAA person. I had a bit of problems with asthma, so that stuck me, that prevented my getting involved in football things. But there were other things, and there was plenty to do for a young lad growing up in Ballinamore. Fishing, out on the lake, swimming. I have very happy memories of being out in a boat with other young people on Garradice Lake, which is quite a sizable lake. On sunny summer's day. I know it sounds a bit idyllic, but it was, right, actually, when you think of it. And there were great times. And I remember we had one of the first television sets in Ballinamore on our road. And on the first night of RTE's transmission, Telefiche Éireann, as it was at the time, the whole street poured into our house to watch the box in the corner with us. In fact, there were so many people sitting on the couch in the middle of the room that the couch went down through the floorboards, went down through the carpet and the floorboards and left a big hole. But nobody moved because everybody was so fixed on the wonderful box in the corner with the signals coming out of it. Little did I know that I'd end up television being very much central to my life.
It's a very funny story how that starts and kind of graduates the whole way through your life through RIARC and through RTE. Yeah. But I believe I have contacts who knew you back then in my life, i.e. my mother. And I believe you were a bit of a sparky back then. You were allowed to rig up the house with all sorts of electrical equipment.
I was very interested in electricity and all the things about it. And I connected up the various extra lamps and extra bulbs and so on. Up in the attic, I was rooting around with connecting little connectors and and more wires and stuff. I'm sure they took a fierce risk really, allowing me, 12, 13 years of age, to start rewiring and connecting up the electricity for the house. But they did, and gave me my head, and I had all sorts of little gadgets in the house.
So it would be pretty safe to assume that being an electrician might have been an option for you, but that's not the route you went when you were leaving Cistercian College, Roscrea.
No, being an electrical engineer was the thing that I would probably have been if I hadn't gone for this job. But and I remember the day I made the decision. A very good friend of mine in class was also going for electronic engineering, as it was, and we were both walking past University Church on Stephen's Green in Dublin, which was the summer after we did the leaving, and we said, let's go in here and have a look. And the place was beautiful. It is beautiful. It's a Byzantine architecture, and it's full of mosaics and frescoes and so on. But I remember seeing a man waiting to go into confession, and he looked worried. And I saw at the same time, I noticed the priest inside the confessional stood up and began to go. And he spotted the man and put two and two together and got four and went back into the confessional and sat down and pulled the curtains. Sure enough, the man went into confession. And we continued our tour of the church and came back by the end of the church where the confessionals were to see the guy leaving the box. A different person. He was a different man. He had a spring to his step and a smile on his lips. And I remember saying to myself, I noticed it and saying, whatever that man was doing in that confessional is something worthwhile. It's changed this man's life. And that played in my mind. It's only a small thing, but I never said it to Fintan, just my friend. We just kept going, but it was extraordinary, really, and there were other signs as well that were pointing me in this direction. Otherwise, I might have been an electronic engineer. You never know, space traveller or something might be interesting for me.
Would religion have been a big part of your life growing up?
Well, I suppose it was a very I wouldn't say it was an overly religious household, but we did go to Sunday masses always, and devotions on a Sunday evening, and Lent was very special. We did extra things for Lent. I'd say it was there. I had an uncle, a priest, my mother's sister, you know, Father Sean. You heard us talk about him before, Father Sean Carey, and he was in Dublin, and he was in among a number of parishes, East Wall and Marino, and I remember staying with him one time, and I liked the things he was doing. It was worthwhile stuff. He was one of the originators of the credit union in Marina, because at that time too, young people were finding it hard to afford a new house. And he saw the problem immediately and began. A group of them got together and set up the credit union, one of the first in Ireland. So, and he was also a deeply spiritual man. He was a holy man. And I think that attracted me too about him. So a number of reasons came to play in my decision to go into Dunleith and give it a whirl, try it out anyway.
You had, Father Sean was one inspiration, but you also had a fairly inspirational mother yourself. Veronica McCarthy was some woman.
She was a great woman. She, but not in the religious sphere. In fact, I remember one time, when I was in my seminary days, she said to me one time, if you ever want to quit, to leave it, just leave it. No, let go. She wasn't sort of pushing me toward him. I'm sure, I think she was probably happy that I was ordained all right. But she never pushed me into it. And it's been a very interesting career. It's been a career, I can call it that, I suppose. It's been a career with a difference. I haven't done that much parish work. I was in Athy for 2 years, and I was in the Pro-Cathedral for 9 years. For seven of them, I was an administrator. And otherwise, I've been involved with making television programmes.
I want to talk to you about RIARC, because this is before my time, and I know very little about it, so I'm quite interested in finding out more about the work that you did at that stage of your life. First of all, what was RIARC?
RIARC was a series of television programmes which began within the first month of RTE's existence. Father Joe Dunn and Des Forrestal and Peter Namas and one or two others were the early members of the RIARC team. And before RTE opened, the Archbishop of Dublin had sent Joe and Des for television training in New York. He plucked them out of their jobs as chaplains in different jobs in Dublin, different places in Dublin, and sent them off to New York. He picked his men very carefully. So they did some basic training in television. Then Joe bought a camera with a loan of money from John Charles McQuaid. And it was an Oricon Pro 600 special, striped sound of the edge of the 16mm film. And they began to make short little programs just to gain some experience, and made a few of them. And the man who was to be the future controller of television, and his name was Michael Barry, with Paddy O'Reilly, Joe invited them to come to his flat in Stephen's Green University House, the house beside University Church. He was chaplain in the college at the time. And he had set up his sitting room as a cutting room, and he put a hole in the wall upstairs of a fourth floor, hole in the wall of a listed building.
You wouldn't get away with that today.
Put a projector in the study, and projected the pictures, the films, onto the wall of his bedroom. And the two guys sat on the bed and watched and listened to these programs. And Michael Barry afterwards said, "Can you make more of those? I want those on television when it opens." So, within 12 days of its opening, came the first RIARC program. And it was a magazine. It was two or three items on two different subjects, a bit like Nationwide today. Yeah. And there was no other program that was giving stuff to RTE shot around the country. And it was the first countrywide filming unit. It was also the first independent production unit, because we were independent of RTE. So a couple of years later, Joe came into the seminary where I was, and he made some inquiries about who we should talk to, and he came into my room and invited me to, "Would you be interested in joining what we're doing in the summertime? When you're on your holidays?" I said, "Of course I would. Yeah, absolutely. I really would." So that's where I began working with film and learning how to edit, to shoot, to provide music, to write commentaries, and so on. So I cut my teeth very early on.
RIARC produced, as a collective, produced many, many documentaries. You were involved in some of the more memorable ones. The one that comes to my mind from memories as a child is the interview with Rose Kennedy, the mother of both JFK and his brother Bobby, obviously, who were both assassinated, one as president, one as a presidential nominee. How did that come about? And
well, I'd have to bring you back to my spending 2 years in a tie. And there was a tragedy one Sunday afternoon when a girl called Magella Timpson was out riding with a friend of hers, and she wasn't accustomed to horses at all. But the horse that she was on shied, seeing its reflection in a puddle, and reared up and threw the girl. And she got serious head injuries, was moved to the hospital in Dublin, and died 4 days later. Everybody knew her in the town. She was a very charming young woman, 18 years of age. I knew her too. I used to call her Thoroughly Modern Millie. But she was the youngest daughter of a family of four, three brothers, and then a long gap, and along comes Magella. So she's the apple of her parents' eye, Paddy and Sarah. And the funeral took place and all the rest of it, and everybody was in bits, especially the young people, because the first person of their own age that they'd seen die. But a couple of weeks later, there was a brainstorming session of RIARC, the RIARC team, and we discussed the programmes that we should be making for the coming year. And I suggest that, could we do a programme that might help parents to deal with the sudden and tragic death of a child? We couldn't ask the Timpsons to do it because it was too raw. We couldn't ask another family that had a tragedy down in Cork a month earlier. My father and three children went into the Lee, leaving a wife and baby. That was probably a bit too raw too. And somebody dryly said, well, I suppose we could always ask the woman who's lost not one but four children tragically and suddenly. Who? Rose Kennedy. Oh, we'd never get near her. We wouldn't. But to make a long story short, we did. through the brother of Eddie Delaney, the sculptor, who was a parish priest of Palm Beach in Florida. And Rose used to go to Mass in Palm Beach Church on her times down in Florida. So we sent a letter and we made contact with her, and we got positive vibe from her through Brother Delaney. And then Des wrote a letter saying in more precise terms what we would want to do with the with her for the programme. So soon after that, along came a cable to say, Mrs. Kennedy unfortunately regrets that she cannot proceed with this project. Signed, J. Sanderson, her secretary. And we were all in shock. Bits. I'd even bought a new camera for the job. And this was now 1973. And the upshot of it was that we decided to ask her why. But we couldn't phone or write because we'd get nowhere. The only thing to do was to get on a plane and go out and talk to her. That's what I did. We had a meeting the following morning, 10 o'clock or 9:30. And by 2:30, I was at the airport waiting for the flight to the States and had to go through New York and then up to Boston. Got a car there and drove down the next day to Hyannisport. Walked in. We had sent a cable on the way to say I was coming. So she was upstairs, changing into green in my honour, according to the lady J. Sanderson, who was her secretary. So she invited me in, and she was very, very, very hospitable altogether and very welcoming. But she said, you didn't have to come all this way, Father. You didn't have to come all this way. I mean, yeah, she came all this way. I said, yes, I did, because we considered it important enough to come and talk to you about it. And wouldn't do it with letters or phone calls or wires. So she gave me a couple of reasons why she had said no. She had said that, that the letter that Des had sent her had implied that she'd have to have details about names and places and so on, and she wouldn't remember them all and she would look stupid and she'd ruin our programme, she said. And the second reason was because she was writing a book and because our publishers didn't want her to do television before the book came out. So she turned it down. So I said, well, could I have that letter of Father Des? So she gave me the letter. She had it in a file in front of her. She gave me the letter. I tore it up in front of her. I said, we don't need to know about names and dates and places and facts. We can get all that from archives. Let me tell you a story. And I told her about Magella Timpson and about this girl killed in the thigh. And have you, from your experience, four times you've been through this tragically and hugely public, the whole world watching, how did you deal with it? Something to help Paddy and Sarah Timpson and other parents who have lost children suddenly and tragically. And that's why we're doing this film. And secondly, in relation to television and the book, my mother is county librarian for Leitrim, a county in Ireland. And she has often told us that she would like us to keep her abreast of what's on television and what's on film, so that she can then get the books to have them in stock when people would come wanting to read about John Galsworthy. When First Sight Saga was first shown, that was a series that was very popular on BBC. Everybody was watching the First Sight Saga on a Sunday night, written by John Galsworthy. People would come and they'd want books by John Galsworthy. When Anne of a Thousand Days was shown in the cinemas, people would all want to get lives of Henry VIII, Anne Boleyn. All right. So it's the other way around. Television comes first, and that inspires the call for the books.
How was the interview?
And she agreed. And I can tell you, when I didn't jump up and strangle her with a kiss and a hug, I was thrilled a bit. And she invited me to stay for the weekend, and I stayed in Jack's own bedroom, and his bed with his school certificates around the wall. And she was a lovely lady. I got to know her quite well. The interview went very well. Eventually, we came back a month later to do the program. I had no cameras or anything like that with me when I was talking to her. We just came back a month later and did the program, and it was called Mother of the Kennedys. And I suppose in today's parlance, you could say it went viral. It was shown on RTE on the 10th anniversary of the assassination of the president. And then in other places as well, including the States.
What other shows and documentaries that you did across the RIARC years stand out for you as particular highlights, or that the message was important to you?
I suppose, that's a hard one, but I suppose the one that stands out among others is Night Flight to Uli. Uli, U-L-I, is a place in Nigeria where there is a long stretch of main road that had been cleared to allow planes to land on it with foodstuffs, food for people who were the Biafran people who were starving. A film crew from RTE had been recalled from going there. They were halfway there from Lisbon. But we managed to get there. And indeed, I remember well, on a Sunday afternoon, we were going to be going on Tuesday, but on Sunday afternoon I went to bed for a few hours because I knew I wouldn't get much sleep over the next few days. And the phone rang, and it was a call from Rome. And the call said, you guys are supposed to be going from Amsterdam on Tuesday. Now you're going from Copenhagen tomorrow. I said, what? Copenhagen tomorrow. The phone was put down. And I was, you know, did he say Copenhagen? Did he say tomorrow? What's happening? Anyway, it was Copenhagen, not Amsterdam, that we left from. And we had to get there by the following day, lunchtime. And we flew in this plane that was a food plane, and there were 10 tons of stockfish in it and some motorcycles. And we took off from Copenhagen, propeller driven, and flew down to Rome, where we collected aspirins and autocycles, and then to Casablanca and down along the coast of Africa, overnight in Casablanca in a hotel. The Hotel Marhaba, I remember well, was the name of it, which means welcome in Arabic. And it was a pretty seedy place. But we eventually arrived in Sao Tome, the Portuguese staging post for the food that was coming as aid from Europe. It was an island about 300 miles off the coast of Nigeria. And that's where the planes went in from every night. And an Irish priest called Father Tony Byrne, he's still around, ran this airlift, bought the planes, and then hired the pilots from mercenary pilots who, you know, agreed to fly these planes. Some of them died in the effort. But the night we went in on the flight, George McCommie was the name of the pilot, and he was killed the following Sunday. He flew into the ground because the lights had been switched off. And something was wrong with the altimeter as well. You know, the whole. But anyway, yeah. He flew into the jungle, and was killed. But we got in and we made this documentary about the starving people of Biafra. And they suffered from a thing called kwashiorkor. And you should have seen the kids with the bulbous eyes and skin, thin legs and arms and swollen stomachs and all the signs of kwashiorkor. And this was very much in the film, and it was the first famine that was televised. And so the film was broadcast back in Ireland, and it came into the sitting rooms and the kitchens of the country. And it was out of that that concern grew. And two development agencies owe their origins to the Biafra struggle. One was Concern, Africa Concern, it was called at the time. Later on, it was just Concern. And you know about Concern now, it's worldwide. A fantastic organization. It had already just begun in a small way, but when the film was shown, boom, it took off and shiploads of food were sent out. And the second agency was Médecins Sans Frontières, the French group, who are doing terrific work all over the world, and particularly in the Middle East at the moment.
Were you concerned for your own safety at any point in those?
Well, you'd have to be, but you don't dwell on it, you know. You get on with the job and do it. There was one occasion, it was a bit funny. We were filming a health clinic in the bush, and I was running out of film, and I had to go back to the jeep that we had, so I'd run quite a distance. So I ran over to the jeep, and it's a couple of hundred yards, and got her in the other roll of film. But when I came back, everybody had gone, disappeared. And I hadn't noticed that there was the sound of a plane overhead. It was the intruder, as they called it. The intruder was an enemy plane scouting the countryside below for bombing raids. So if they had stayed out in the open, they would have been bombed, or could have been bombed. But they had gone into the trees. I was all on my own in this clearing with a plane above.
See, that just sounds... What did the people around you think? What did your family think about you putting yourself into these situations?
Well, they didn't know. They wouldn't have known that it was that dangerous, I suppose. And flying in was another story. In from Sao Tome, we were... I never saw anti-aircraft fire before, but there were anti-aircraft guns positioned in Nigeria, which had previously been property of, being the area overrun by the Biafrans right to the coast. But as the Federal Army of Nigeria began to press them in, they had to leave the coast. So the Federals put up bloody big anti-aircraft guns to knock these planes out of the sky. And we got fired on at one stage, and George McCormick was throwing the plane around the sky, you know, in order to avoid them. It was exciting stuff, you know.
Did you fear for your own life?
No, I didn't. I didn't think that much. I was too excited.
So Biafra, Rose Kennedy, some others you mentioned when we were talking earlier was Brazil, Newfoundland and Listunvarna.
Well, yeah, it's a funny mix, isn't it?
Well, Listunvarna in particular interests me because some people would say, listen to this, what the hell is a priest doing at a matchmaking festival?
It wasn't a matchmaking festival. It's just the time in Listunvarna. There wasn't a festival there as such that time. It was where people went when the harvest was in. Farmers went down there for a holiday and to look for a wife. And sometimes they found one. Mostly they didn't. But the girls used to go there too, because it was the market for men, if you like. A priest, why not be there to assist people to find a partner and to make a program which publicised that throughout the country so that more and more people could come.
So the program was about the search for your partner?
Yeah. Marriage bureaus, all the rest of it, marriage counselling, marriage guidance, are all part of the church's work. And this is
suppose marriage is a as you kindly reminded me at the start of the show, marriage is a sacrament.
That's right, yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. So Brazil and Newfoundland?
Brazil, we went to Brazil in 77 and we had to bribe our way in, but it was an extraordinary place because there was being practiced there what they call liberation theology. And liberation theology was something that had grown out of the writings of a man called Paulo Freire. And the people were following this line of Freire. And it's who is for liberation, you know, is about freeing people. There were very, very poor people. The favelas around the place were extraordinarily poor. Favelas being a shantytown on the edges of Sao Paulo and Rio. And wonderful people there as missionaries, Irish missionaries. First of all, there was the medical missionaries and the Holy Rosary Sisters. They're the two nuns' orders that were there. And three men's, Kiltigans, Columbans, and Holy Ghosts. Kiltigans, Holy Ghosts, and Oblates. And the Redemptorists, there were four orders there. And they were doing wonderful work with people in great poverty situations. And it was a military government at the time, and we had to be very careful not to get too obvious in what we were doing. And when we were leaving the island, I knew, not the island, but the country, I knew that an Italian crew had had their film confiscated a few weeks before us. And a German crew had had their boxes of film opened and then closed again, rendering them useless. So I divided the crew into two, and some of us went ahead to Rio. I stayed in Sao Paulo with two others, and with one other, actually, Darby Connaughton. And we went through the customs in Sao Paulo, with all laughing and giggling, and like tourists coming out of it. It was carnival time, and the place was full of carnival spirit. But the other guys up in Rio had the important stuff. So if anything had happened to us back in Rio, back in Sao Paulo, a message would be sent to Rio: don't go on the flight, don't check it through. And I had made another arrangement for the film to be got back to Ireland.
Oh, Cloak and Dagger.
Yeah, yeah.
You kind of you hear stories about that sort of stuff in movies.
Yeah.
But to actually kind of hear about it in real life, you don't really believe that's possible, or that those kind of stuff happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless you're smuggling stuff that you shouldn't be smuggling.
Yeah, well, the stuff that we had in our cases and bags from Sao Paulo was fairly innocuous stuff, you know, landscapes and so on, and people going about their jobs, but the issues were touched upon, were dealt with in depth actually in the film that the guys had in Rio. And I remember we landed in Sao Paulo, in Rio. We took off from Sao Paulo and went via Rio, and we were transiting in the transit lounge of Rio. And I remember one time I was standing at a rack of postcards, admiring them. And Brian O'Reilly, our cameraman, was on the other side of the same rack of cards. But we couldn't agree, we couldn't look at each other, couldn't pass any remarks, didn't know who we were, as if a total stranger. Because the secret police were everywhere. So, no recognition at all. And when we got on the plane, and the plane took off, I called for double brandies for the whole crew.
I can imagine. It sounds kind of like, I don't know if you've seen the movie Argo.
I have, yes.
It sounds very similar to that. It's kind of, you're sitting on the plane, just take off.
Yeah.
Moving on, after Ryark.
Newfoundland.
Oh, sorry, Newfoundland.
The other area you mentioned. Newfoundland is an extraordinary place. Because there was immigration from the southeast to Newfoundland in the 18th century, And we met people who are descended from those people in the southern part of Newfoundland who have broad Waterford accents and South Tipperary accents.
Yeah, and a St. John's, yeah. St. John's, Newfoundland, their accent is a very Dublin similar accent.
Well, I'm not sure about the Dublin bit.
Definitely Irish.
Oh, Irish, absolutely. But particularly the Waterford and Kilkenny and South Tipperary accents. Yet, they are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 generations removed from Irish people. And they're still speaking with broad rural accents from Ireland. And it was marvellous to see that and to study it and talk to the people and to do films about them. We did. Edmund Ignatius Rice sent a nephew of his who got into trouble in Waterford. He sent him out to Newfoundland on a fishing boat, on one of the boats, one of the ships. And he grew up and made his life in Newfoundland. And I met at a party in a place called Carbonear. The man of the house introduced the young man to me. He says, "Does this man look familiar to you?" I said, "I don't think so." "You should know him, because he's very like his ancestor. Same shape of a face and all that." And wasn't it? His name was Edmund Ignatius Rice.
That's mad.
A direct descendant of the man at the who founded the Christian Brothers.
That's phenomenal. Mm. I used to watch a TV show from Newfoundland called Republic of Doyle, and the main character, the main actor in the show was Sean McGinley.
Yeah.
And he just spoke in his normal accent and he fitted in perfectly. You wouldn't have known he was Irish and the rest of the cast were from Newfoundland.
I remember one Sunday afternoon filming over there, and it was a foggy day, and there was an outdoor parish fete being held, and with, you know, a tombola and magic rings and so on, and all sorts of fun and games for all the family, and it was being held outdoors. And my cameraman on that trip was Donald Wilde, who himself was fascinated by the whole story of Newfoundland. He's from South Tipperary. And it was a Fellini-like scene of these people in the fog, you know, enjoying themselves nevertheless. But I said to Donald to go off and film, and I won't tell you who to film, people who are with distinctly Irish features, people who look Irish, as they're throwing rings or whatever, having an ice cream and so on. And I would meanwhile search and look for people to interview, to talk to. And Donald said, "Sure, how many minutes do you think will this be on air for, this bit, the sequence?" I said, "It'll probably be about, I would think, 4 minutes. Let's get 4 minutes with the pictures." So at about 7 minutes, 7 seconds per shot, you can work out how many pictures you need, how many shots you need for about 4 minutes of edited material.
55.
Yeah. So you have to, so off he went with his camera. And they got people of all ages and Irish features. And it was a wonderful sequence in the film. And I spoke to people then who were interested in talking about it to me. Anyway, Newfoundland was great. In fact, actually, the Canadian ambassador to Ireland, until recently, was a man called Loyola Hearn. And he was a principal of a school before he began to into politics. He was principal of a school in Newfoundland, and thought he'd try to do something to influence people to get more employment and so on, because they were leaving the place, they were leaving the island and going to Canada, etc., go to the mainland. So the whole story about Loyola is another story. He's just a fantastic guy, wonderful fellow. He left education and went into politics and ended up as Minister for Education and then Minister for Fisheries and Oceans. And he was the one who was responsible for the legislation to really put a stop to sweeping up the cod and to the destruction of the cod market. And He's a great guy, but he came from Newfoundland. And he saw the programs we had done years and years ago. And he was excited when he saw one of them, one of the programs, The Forgotten Irish. He got on the phone and spoke to people in Newfoundland. He says, I'm watching your father here doing a set dance 40 years ago. And your mother as well. They weren't even married at the time, but I'm watching them here on television in Ireland. So it was great excitement.
When did the Pro Cathedral come around? Because that would have been what I would remember you when I was a child growing up.
Yeah, I went to the Pro in 82 and was there until 91. And as I said, for quite a number of those years, I was administrator of the place. And that's a very historic place to be, for a start. And it's got four lives, the Pro Cathedral. First of all, it's the life of a cathedral for the big diocesan occasions, you know, state funerals and new archbishop installed and funeral of the last one and so on, all that kind of thing, the state things. Secondly, it's a working church of a parish church. Now, admittedly, the parish of the Pro Cathedral is rather small, but it's there and it has all the features of any parish. It has its schools, it has its old folks, it has its people living there that you visit, and it's life as a parish, children's first communions and so on, confessions and confirmation. And all that has to be looked after. And thirdly, it's the service church. For so many people in Dublin who come into the Pro and go to Mass each day, and they're the elderly people who are very often retired, and tourists who come in all the time. So, in fact, 1 million people went through the Pro Cathedral every day while we were there, every year while we were there. The footfall was 1 million every year. How do we know that? By the number of communions that we gave out. Fourthly, this is the type of church that I've got particularly involved with, is it's young people. It's a focal point for young people. And it's something that was very attractive to the people involved with the Taizé. Have you heard of Taizé in France?
I'm familiar with it, but mostly through yourself.
Brother Roger and Taizé. Old Taizé movement, and there was it was very popular in the 80s. Old mission to young people who were wandering up and down not knowing what to do with themselves, or sometimes in the pubs only at weekends in the centre of Dublin. And the Archbishop at the time, Dermot Ryan, when asking me to go to the place, said, I hope you'll come up with some initiatives that would meet the needs of our young people. And we did. We put on a whole young youth apostolate at the Pro. So it was a very busy place and a most exciting place. We did a couple of plays while we were there too, large-scale dramas.
One is springing into mind, and I could be wrong on this, but The Crozier and the Crown?
That's right, that was the second one. The Crozier and the Crown was a play that I commissioned from my colleague Des Forrestal, which was about the Crown was the king and the Crozier was the abbot of Lenstal, or the abbot of Glendalough, who became Archbishop of Dublin, Laurence O'Toole. So it was about the tension between the two and the raid on Dublin by the Norman troops. And we had a ding-dong battle in the Pro Cathedral one night. So that was a great great success. And the other one was those 3 days, which was a passion play. And we involved professional actors as well as local amateurs, because we were in the middle of all the professional theatres. We had the Abbey and the Gate and so on quite near us, and I got to know them all, the actors at the different places, and they contributed, and of course they got paid, but it packed the place out for 8 days, and I think The Crozier and the Crown was even longer. I don't remember the exact number of days. But there were major dramas in the place. Brought a lot of people in. And fascinating stories come from it. Like, in order to get better sound the second time round, as the first time hadn't been great sound reinforcement by radio mics. Radio mics were actually, is that?
No, it's fine.
Radio mics were new, but they weren't good enough really for the plays. They were okay, but if Cyril Cusack as Herod sat on his antenna, he'd go off air, you know. So the second play, we had The Crozier and the Crown, but I got a guy in London called Philip Lever, who ran a company called Autograph Sound Limited, to come and look after the sound reinforcement. And we built a little chorale at the back of the Pro Cathedral for his equipment to be in it, you know. He had, say, 16 microphones, and he had to do all the changing and so on his faders. And the chorale was back against the back of the church, and I'd shifted a couple of statues to let them get back into get back to the back wall. And Philip was in the little caboche, little chorale, doing his preparation on the day before the dress rehearsal. And this woman stood in front of him with two shopping bags. She said, "Where's St. Jude?" And he didn't realise she was talking to him, and then he did, and said, "Oh, I beg your pardon, madam. Pardon? Where's St. Jude? What did you do to St. Jude?" Oh, and then twigged it, Philip, what had happened. "Oh, I think you'll find him. I think you'll find him in the second confession box on the left." It was the statue of St. Jude, of course. And so on. Things like that. What you do to him?
While we're talking about funny anecdotes and funny things that happened during your time, there's two stories that my mother has told me, your sister, which you may not thank her for, but they're funny. And you may not even have the same recollection of them, but one was of a night in a Thai. She was working as a locum doctor in that area. You were sharing accommodation, sharing a house. And one night, very late, a phone call came in for her to go to an accident.
Yeah.
And she went, and you were kind of very smugly laughing at the fact that she had to get out of her warm bed and get dressed and go out and do work. Mm. At which point she went to the accident, and it was some guy who was drunk and was having a bit of an issue, but nothing serious, nothing wrong at all. The ambulance was called out as well, and the ambulance were going to drop him home because they were familiar with him. You're smiling at me across the room.
Yeah, I remember it. Yeah.
The instruction she gave the ambulance was to ring the hospital and tell them to call for the priest. The priest was needed at the... Yeah. But of course, by the time you got there, they were long gone. Everyone was gone. She was back in bed, and you spent hours searching in the middle of nowhere before mobile phones and everything.
That's right.
For an accident.
That's right. We used to... if a call came during the night, and she was... while Beth was staying with me, your mum... I'd say during the night, "Well, is it body or soul?" "This is the body." And I'd pound on the wall of Beth's bedroom and "It's for you." And she, "Oh God," she'd be out of bed, you know. And then, so she got her own back anyway, because I'd been laughing, you know.
Yeah, she said you very smugly, you had told her it was her turn to get up.
Yeah.
So she decided she'd have the last laugh. There's also another funny story she tells about the reason, one of the catalysts maybe, as to why you ended up in a Thai in the first place. And it was to do with an encounter with a nun at a door.
I don't remember. What?
Something about a young trainee nun or novice.
Yeah.
Was at the answered the door at a convent, and was very matter of fact and very prim and proper and very formal, and you and somebody with you, one or other of you, made a comment along the lines of, "Oh, loosen up! You think that Reverend Mother was standing over your shoulder, when in fact the Reverend Mother was standing over her shoulder and took offence at the."
Oh, I see.
It's not ringing bells with you.
No, it doesn't ring a bell with me. No, there were many things that would happen about convents at that time. They were quite. Resistant to change, and that's the program we made. We made a couple of programs, two of them actually. One was Convent Walls Are Falling Down, and the other was New Nuns for Old. The Vatican Council had suggested that there were changes that should happen in religious women's orders, and in the big five women, Irish women's orders, the Mercies and Presentations and so on, they were being resisted, change was being resisted by the powerful people within the congregations and the bishops. So once we started working on it and researching it, I was getting phone calls from young sisters who were coming down out of their beds to the phone at the bottom of the stairs in Connemara to say, listen, for God's sake, do make this program. Do make the program. We do need change. Things have to change. And others would say, we're getting on to me to lay off the nuns and so on. So we made the two programs, and they had quite an effect, I think. Anyway, that was one of the reasons I got sent to Athy, which I, as things turned out, enjoyed very much.
After the Pro Cathedral, you got a fantastic position within RTE as the head of religious programming on TV.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, they needed somebody to take religious programs in hand, and also they needed to have somebody who knew something about religion and at the same time knew something about television and something about administration. So I suppose I was an obvious choice to be called to come in for an interview. And I did, and got the job. And what they wanted me to do was to shake it up. Religious programs had fallen into a bit of a doldrums after Billy Fitzgerald had left some years previously. He had been there too. And so I started this program, which is still running, called Would You Believe? And we did other series, shorter series from time to time. And then we did major things like the events that are part and parcel of the church's life, like the death of Mother Teresa, for instance. That was extraordinary. Diana died the previous weekend. And then Mother Teresa, I'm trying to think now, it was in August. Mother Teresa died on the day of the funeral. Funeral. So Mary Kennedy, I thought it would be good for Mary to come out and do a joint commentary together on Mother Teresa's life and death.
Because if people are listening to this and maybe aren't familiar with you, I'm pretty sure they've heard your voice.
Yeah.
And this is where they would be very familiar with your voice.
Yes. Yes, I know that. People often say, oh, I recognize your voice. I know your voice all over the place. I get that. I think we did the longest commentary live, non-stop, in the history of RTE. I don't know anyone that did it longer. We were five and three-quarter hours.
That's a long time.
Live on air from Calcutta. And the details of it are a bit too long to go into now, but it was by the skin of the teeth that we got it out, you know. And Mother Teresa's death was an extraordinary event. Everybody wanted to have a say in the funeral plans. The state of India, the local state, the city of Calcutta, the missionaries of charity, the diocese of Calcutta, they all wanted to have their spoke. The army, she got a state funeral. It was a tremendous, amazing reaction to see the thousands and thousands of people for days and days queuing to go back to go into the church in the centre of the city. That was the place where her body was laid. She was an amazing lady, and the funeral was an extraordinary event. I'll never forget it.
In terms of Mother Teresa, just that, now that you mentioned her, obviously she's very close, if not already been canonized. She's that process has been very much fast tracked. What's your own personal thoughts on that?
Well, I think she was indeed a very, very saintly woman, and she has, and the required miracles have happened in her name. So I think the Pope didn't see any reason to delay it.
Fair enough.
Mm.
Obviously, also Pope John Paul II, you would have been commentating on his funeral also from Rome, from the Vatican.
And various other ceremonies that he'd been involved in through the years leading up to beatifications of Irish people and so on, that kind of thing. Columba Marmion and Edmund Rice, indeed. And his funeral then was huge. It was I think it was 4 million people who converged on Rome for that. It's the largest funeral in the history of the world. And people who have been to Rome will know St. Peter's Square in front of the Basilica of St. Peter. That was full. The area around the Circus Maximus, another enormous area, that was full. The front of St. John Lateran Basilica, that was full. There was any large space around Rome was full of people. And it was an amazing sight to be up on the roof of the Jesuit headquarters where we were based with our position, and to see down below the crowds surging up Via della Conciliazione all day and all night in 15 deep across the street to go into the cathedral or into the basilica to pay their respects for his body. It was an extraordinary feat altogether of organisation as well as everything else, but he was deeply loved, deeply, deeply loved, and the half of Poland seemed to be in Rome that week.
We also had a very unique situation when we're talking about popes in the last number of years.
Yeah.
With the, I'm not sure the official title for it, but the stepping down of one pope and the installation of a second while the first pope was still alive. How unique is that? And is that something we can maybe expect to see going forward, or was that just...
That's completely unique. Only one other pope had ever resigned before, hundreds of years ago. But I think Benedict will be remembered mostly for his resignation, for stepping down. It was a very courageous thing to do. I think he felt that the job was getting beyond him. There was so much that needed to be done, and there was the whole abuse situation had to be dealt with. The money was being laundered all over the place. There were characters in the Vatican who were clearly career people, careerists, and remember the documents being stolen from his office and so on. It was just one thing after another, and I think he just felt, I'm too old for this, I'm not able for it, and he had the honesty to stand up and say, I'm out of here. But the one they got in his place is incredible.
That was my next question, because St. Francis really has, or Pope Francis has really captured the imagination of people who maybe had lost whatever faith they had or whatever belief in religion they had. I know I was in the US this last year when he came through, and the reaction to him was phenomenal. It was like a superstar, coming, a super pop star or a celebrity movie star that we'd normally have. That was the kind of reception and reaction he was getting.
Yeah, he doesn't want that.
No, he's more happy to be heading down the pizzeria to get his own pizza.
That's right, or calling in to visit the poor people.
Yes.
He does that everywhere he goes. He's an incredible gift to the church at the moment, and we're very fortunate that he's there, and it's what the church needed. He has set out a program of reform in the Vatican for a start, which is beginning to take effect. And before he became Pope, when he was at the conclave meeting, before he went into the conclave, I mean, there were congregations, which they called congregatio, meetings 3 times a day of all the cardinals, and each person had a chance to say his few words, what should happen, who should happen, what it needed. And he waited until the last day. He waited until Monday morning. Tuesday, the conclave was beginning. And he spoke only one page, handwritten. And he says, what this place needs is purification. It's over-clericalized. And it needs to draw in the periphery, people at the edge who have no say and are forgotten, the poor and the marginalized and so on. And he said it all in just one page, spoke for 4 minutes instead of the allotted 7. And when he was finished, clearly the cardinals said to each other, or said to themselves, that's the man we want as Pope. And went in and elected him, Bergoglio, Archbishop of Buenos Aires. And the person sitting beside him in the Sistine Chapel was Cardinal Humes, H-U-M-M-E-S, from Sao Paulo. And I think he said Paulo Barrio. It's Sao Paulo as far as I know. He was a friend of his. And he turned to Bergoglio when he saw that he was getting really worried. God, they're just getting very like, they're going to put me in this job, you know. So, and he just said to him, patience, think of Francis, think of the poor. And that's why he chose the name Francis. There and then. But it shouldn't have been a surprise that he was chosen. He had come second at the previous conclave, but somehow or other he didn't figure in the media. And I was sitting in the newsroom studio on the 6 o'clock news with Tom McCarthy, a Dominican, no relation, who's been also been doing the commentaries from Rome. And we were there in the studio that evening, and Brian Dobson was in the square in Rome, and we got the name from the announcer, the cardinal who was announcing, I bring you news of great joy and so on. We have a Pope, Annuncio Vobis Gaudium Magnum, Bergoglio. And none of us knew, so quickly, where? He's Buenos Aires, Argentinian. The excitement was incredible, the first Jesuit Pope. So he's doing great work, and doing great work, and changing everything. Even the way, even his accommodation in the place. Some stories have come out, you know, but early on in his reign or in his pontificate, he's wandering down the corridor from the room in the hostel in his pants and shirt, no white satin, with a mug in his hand. He said, "Where do you get a cup of coffee around here?" And just an ordinary man. It's great.
I think that's why people are attracted to what he has to say.
Yeah.
He's an ordinary guy who's saying ordinary things, and people just seem to like it.
He believes it.
Where is the future for the Irish church, for the church in Ireland? It's taken a lot of a bashing over the last 20, 25 years.
How long is this programme?
We have about 5 minutes.
Where's the Irish church going? It's going through a difficult time at the moment. But I think, even though the papers make hay about the fact that fewer and fewer are going to church and Catholic schools are under pressure, there's all that kind of, priests are suspect, unfortunately. Even though all the people I know are doing a marvelous job, wonderful job, very, very tough job now. It's no fun being a priest nowadays, I tell you. But for some guys, for most of us, it's worth doing, because you see the goodness in people. And it's the people, really, who make this job worthwhile. The reaction of people when you do anything, say at a funeral or a wedding, or helping to prepare a funeral and so on, they're very, very appreciative at that time. And sure, guys far more than me are involved in all sorts of organisations and things across the country. And I see it every week, news of young organisations who are doing various things like the Pope John Paul Awards and so on. It's great stuff. But it's not to say that there is conflict between the government and the church. But I'm hopeful. I'm an optimist. And I'm sure that whenever the last person turned the key in the door of Glendalough for the final time, he must have been very upset, saying that's the end of it, it's all over. Glendalough, the abbey is finished, church is finished, and it grew again and grew again and grew again, and it'll come back up. Patience.
You've led a very interesting life, and you've come in contact with a lot of people, and you're lucky enough to count amongst your friends some people that would be well known to people listening, this particularly of an Irish persuasion. You mentioned Mary Kennedy doing commentaries with you. I know she's a personal friend, and there are others. Who are the people who have influenced you most in your life, and who are the people who you respect the most that you've come into contact with?
Well, I suppose that I suppose I've told you about Father Sean Carey. I admired him a lot. he was my uncle, I know, but apart from that, he was a great guy, and he was a great example to me as a young man growing up. People who have influenced me during my life, I would hesitate to name people because there's so many of them, and some of them are dead, a lot of them are dead now. But Peter Lamass, Father Peter Lamass, was a wonderful guy. Des Forrestal was terrific. There's some of my colleagues on Mark. Des was a great guy. Peter was a brilliant man who, I suppose if I say deeply religious, it doesn't really describe him. He was a man who could relate the gospel to daily life very, very well. And he was fired by an enthusiasm and a zest for the gospel. That was remarkable. I'd have to have a bit more warning about this question now to think of others, but there's a lot of people out there.
There's one story that springs to mind, and I had a list of things I wanted to ask you about, and we're an hour in and I haven't even got to you to two or three of the things I really want to talk to you about. One is the Mary McAleese Bridge, and you were involved in the rededication of that in memory of Ireland's eighth president.
I felt that Mary's presidency should be marked by some physical sign. But obviously, there isn't the sort of mood in the country that we're paying for a large lump of stone somewhere. When she came into presidency, she said that one of her principal aims, and of Martin as it turned out, was bridge building between North and South. And I remember we were in the Aran Islands at the time doing some walking, and I said to Martin McAleese, what would Mary think of a bridge being named in her honour? Say the new bridge over the Boyne. Well, he said, ask her. I'm sure she wouldn't say no, but ask herself. So I did. And she said, well, I said, if you got a request from the Louth County Council to have your name on the bridge, what would you do? Well, I wouldn't put it in a drawer, she said. Put it that way. And I can say no more. And she said no more, and there was no need for her to say any more. So, make a long story short, with the help of two men called Kieran Taff, who's a good friend of ours, and of Mary's as well as mine, and Senator Jim Darcy from Louth, who has been fantastic and helped to persuade the politicians in Louth to go ahead with this, and the Meath politicians. So to make a long story short anyway, the bridge was named. It's the Mary McAleese Boyne Valley Bridge. And it's the new bridge over the Boyne on the way between North and South.
Links and, the two capitals.
Belfast very apt over. To have that bridge named after her. There were various hiccups along the way, but it happened. And it was a great day for celebration a couple of years ago when it happened.
There's a pretty historic joke saying, how do you get to Carnegie Hall?
Practice. Yes.
Music has played a huge part in your life.
We haven't really
talked about it today because we just have so much to get through, but music is a huge part of your life. I know you're a very musical person, but you were very involved in the Singing Priests and other musical groups.
Yes.
Over indeed, the years.
Yeah. We did. There were a group of priests, all right, the Old Priest Show, that we did every Thursday night for charity. And I think we raised something in the order of 11 million for charities of all kinds.
Not inconsiderable.
No, and I had to leave, say, somewhere around the middle of the 80s because it just came too busy and working with stuff in the Pro Cathedral. But it was something of its day. You wouldn't do it now. But we were in halls all over the country and hotels, and also in England and the States and Australia. And you mentioned Carnegie Hall. We did Carnegie Hall.
That's why as I said well. That's why I said it.
We played Carnegie Hall on a concert there. It was amazing to think that this is the place where Yehudi Menuhin used to play and Tchaikovsky himself played and so on. We had terrible cheek to be doing it in the first place, but there was a full house and a great night. And also in Sydney, and in Brisbane and Melbourne and various places in England, which was all about charity, raising funds for charity. And a couple of, some of the guys were all priests, had various talents, and we were all kept to, in order by John Wall, Father John Wall. He's now the parish priest of Enniskerry, but he was the fellow who kept the show going. And you had singers and you had instrumentalists and you had comedians and so on, all of whom did their bit on a Thursday night.
The third story, and I'm going to ask you about it because I think it's of interest to the listeners. I know something you don't not particularly fond about talking about was your relationship with Ben Dunne.
Mm.
And in particular, your role. Any older listeners to the show will be familiar with, obviously, Dunne Stores magnate at the time. Was kidnapped, and you were involved in his release.
Yes.
How much can you tell us about that, or how much are you prepared to tell us about that?
Ah, well, I mean, I can talk about it now. It's 30 years ago and more. I first came to know Ben through his sister and her husband, and I met them at the baptism of one of the children. And met Ben and his wife-to-be, Mary Godwin, in their home, in the other, Mary and Liz's home. And we came to know each other, and Ben would make contact now and then, and I'd go around and have a meal or something with him. And it wasn't all the time up there, by no means. But we're good friends, and I did their wedding, and that was a great occasion. It was a small wedding, as it happens. But then I got a phone call one day from from a parish priest, who said, "I have a person on the phone. I had a person on the phone looking for you. I want you to know how he could get you, or wondering, could you come to my phone to take a call between 1 and 2? And that was Tom Feeney, parish priest in Porterstown, the Castleknock. It was a Sunday afternoon. So Ben had been kidnapped some days before this, and the whole country knew about it. Was all about to kidnap Ben Dunne. And I kind of guessed that I might be involved at some time, but I didn't know how. Anyway, this phone call came to Tom, and I was at that number when the call came, telling me to be at a certain place in Louth village at a certain time. And you get further instructions. So, I didn't take my own car, but I went up to Louth and waited at a telephone kiosk and got instructions, finally, from a voice with a northern accent, to be in the village of Knockbridge, 3 miles away, in a few minutes. And the same, go to the telephone kiosk. So I went to the kiosk in Knockbridge and waited there for the phone to ring. And the phone eventually rang and told me, turn around in the kiosk and up over the door, you'll find instructions where to go. So the paper was there with instructions to go along a certain road. It said no more, keep going. So I went along the certain road and came to a T-junction. And I had been told to turn left at the junction. And within a few hundred yards of the junction, three guys with rifles and their masks stepped out in front of me and urged me to drive in behind the gate, and so on and so forth. The conversation with the three of them began, but they were a bit afraid that they were too near the road, so we went off across a field and to a disused farm complex and into a pigsty, which was out of date and had been dried earth on the floor, but it was a small room, and that's where we were having the chat, that we were talking. So I won't go into the details of the conversation, but out there for 40 minutes talking to them. I didn't know, first of all, whether they actually had been, whether they were the kidnappers, or whether there were some other members of the IRA jumping on the bandwagon. So, but the shots anyway began to ring out at one stage when they went out, and the army and policemen, the guard, the two guardi and a soldier, came towards us. They had just gone out to have a chat among themselves about something I had said to them, and they were spotted. It's just look or bad look, in their case. But they got away, but there was an exchange of bullets fire from their guns and the guns of the security forces. So, anyway, to make a long story short, I did an appeal on the radio, and I was told by the commissioner, the assistant commissioner of the Gardaí, nobody has actually asked for him. Does anybody want this guy? It's a pretty obvious thing to do. So I did a radio appeal, which was played on the 1 o'clock news that day, a few days later. And I'm cutting the story short. And he was released that night.
No ransom, no.
None that I know of. No ransom was paid. There may have been something paid later, but I didn't know about that. And I can't talk about it.
Obviously, you'd been in Africa in situations with bombs and the possibility of planes taking you out at any given time.
Yeah.
Were you aware of the danger you were putting yourself in?
I don't think I was. I knew I was in a dangerous situation, and the Gardaí told me afterwards that I had been in a very dangerous situation. It could have been fatal, but I didn't realise that at the moment. I said an act of contrition, however. I remember going up in the car, I did, just to cover it over myself, and that was then I was so taken up with the action that I didn't think. If I remember when I was down on my hunkers on the floor and the bullets were flying, thinking, what would Kojak do in this situation? Kojak was on television at the time. But however, thanks be to God, the man was released unharmed and restored to his wife that night.
All's well that ends well, I suppose, in that regard.
Yeah. The following night, actually. Two nights after the appeal, yes. Yeah, indeed.
On this show every week, I finish with the same question.
And that you're copying Gay Byrne.
Am I?
Yeah.
From The Meaning of Life,
yeah,
is
that's
it?
That's right, yeah.
I'm not sure what his final question is.
If you met God in heaven, suppose it's all true, suppose you meet him, what are you going to say to him?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to steal Gay Byrne's thunder on that one. My final question is, if the listeners to this show, if you could ask them to do one thing for you or for themselves, what would it be?
Oh, now who are the listeners? I'd say follow your dream. And if you have enough guts, courage to follow that, it'll happen for you. But I think it takes effort to just keep going, to put up with disappointment, put up with setbacks, put up with being different, and just go for it.
Father Dermot McCarthy and my Uncle Dermot, thank you very much for joining me for this week's show. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. You definitely fit the description of interesting, inspirational and motivational, and a complete trendsetter back before anybody was putting themselves in harm's way. It's been an absolute pleasure having the show. I hope you've enjoyed the experience as much as I have. And thank you very much.
Thank you.